Hello, Blogging Heads Nation, back for a final appearance from Denver. I'm Heather Hurlburt from the National Security Network, and I have with me a newcomer to Blogging Heads, Michael Signer, Senior Policy Advisor at Center for American Progress, and former Foreign Policy Advisor John Edwards. So, Michael, welcome to Blogging Heads.
Thanks, Heather. Thanks for having me.
And we promised that this was going to be our transitional show where we talk a little bit about what is happening here in Denver and look ahead to the parallel challenges that the Republicans face next week in Minneapolis. In the truth in advertising category, we should fess up that this is Thursday morning, which means A, we don't know who McCain's running mate is. B, we don't know how Obama does tonight. And C, we are both exhausted after the whole week at the convention. So this is the coffee and donuts, the coffee in the veins, Blogging Heads.
Two coffee in the veins.
So to start off with, Michael, should we talk a little bit about last night, National Security Day, Bill Clinton
Sure.
Day, Joe Biden Day? Did everybody get done what they needed to get done?
I thought so. I felt that especially President Clinton's speech finally really, it closed the deal, and he kind of ran straight through the end zone on the national security question to the extent that there was, I mean, you're a avid, or were, still are, an avid Hillary Clinton supporter, which I respect. I was a John Edwards supporter during the campaign. But he really, I think there was some discontent that I heard a lot in the halls and the parties about whether or not Hillary Clinton, it was an enthusiastic speech, to accomplish a lot of things, but she didn't talk quite as much about the national security part of Senator Obama's campaign, and I think that her husband really did, and he just kind of slam dunked it, and it was totally unqualified and very specific about Senator Obama's qualifications and how he could be commander-in-chief, and how he had the judgment and the strength. And so it was, to that extent, I think it was incredibly successful on that piece of the campaign. So the jigsaw puzzles, I think, are coming together, and we're just waiting now for Obama to finally put the final piece right in the middle tonight.
You mentioned to me earlier that you actually watched last night from the Hawaii Obama family box, which must
Right.
have been an interesting place, because what I was really pleasantly surprised by last night was just how crazy for Bill Clinton the arena went, that there was a level of enthusiasm that I think after all the stuff we've seen, I was not expecting. And people were on their feet cheering the moment he came out, how long it took him to quiet them. It was really, it was a Bill Clinton reception the way I, a former Bill Clinton staffer, remember them. And I thought that said something really good about the party and how ready it is to go forward united.
Oh, I had a very, I agree, I had a very unsettling experience, actually. I came out of the box to go try to get some sodas for the people I was sitting with, and you actually you weren't allowed to bring them in. But while I was making this little errand, Bill Clinton, after his speech, was walking through the hall, and it was literally a riot scene. And people were pressed up against the walls. People, it was a level of intensity of fandom. It was really amazing. And there was a striking contrast, which is I saw Mike Dukakis a little bit farther down the hall, so in the same time frame, and he had, you know, a few people around him who were adoring, but Bill Clinton came through, and there were probably 30 cameras and 200, 300 people pressed up against the wall. It was extraordinary.
I'm still trying to digest the idea that you can't take sodas into skyboxes. Why
they wouldn't?
Why
I don't
the
know.
Hell would you have a skybox?
You could only bring a bottle of water. You couldn't bring. It was. I don't know. Whatever the secret, however the Secret Service works in mysterious ways.
Yeah. No, definitely. We know we've been out here too long when it's starting to get to be a sport to complain about the security at the various
right.
venues. But so since you mentioned Michael Dukakis, one other. I had several people said to me they thought John Kerry had given the speech of his life last night. What did you think of that one?
I agree. And the commentary that I heard from a lot of people was not only did he kind of exude this toughness and specificity that they hadn't seen 4 years ago, they said that he seemed much more comfortable and conversational, I guess, and that the rhetorical element of it was powerful in an easier way that he didn't have. And I don't know what evolution he's gone through, what you know, because I mean, now we're living in a world that has been partially created by what happened then. Maybe that's a dramatic contrast. Actually, when I talked about seeing Dukakis there, I mean, this is I think it's to Kerry's credit that he's adapted, and I think, you know, there was the swift voting, there was the way the national security was played up then and manipulated and exploited in a really horrible way, I think, we probably, all of us think. And it sounds like Kerry really absorbed a lot of those lessons, and he's trying to do everything he can to not repeat them and to win the election for Obama on those grounds.
Yeah, I had myself kind of mixed feelings about Kerry's swift boat line that, you know, on the one hand, it's good to tell a joke on yourself. On the other hand, that was one of the sort of major tactical blunders of the 2004 campaign. And I didn't know that we really needed to be rehashing it on primetime TV.
Right, right. And it's also probably a little bit inside baseball. I mean, to the extent,
yeah,
I think you and I have talked before about these, in politics, you call them process stories and processy things that are about, they're kind of meta. They're politics about politics. And I think that ordinary voters don't care, and they're not interested in politics about politics. So, I mean, swift boat has entered the lexicon. I think it's something people do know about. But whenever you enter in it, it's a cul-de-sac. You're just talking about strategy, and people want to hear about what you're going to do for them.
Yeah. And that this campaign of all campaigns has been so about strategy. And if you think about the stories about this convention, it's been all kind of the inside baseball, Clinton's versus Obama.
The one exception I would add onto that actually is that to the extent that the process elements actually demonstrate to a voter that you have a quality that they're looking for that matters for the job that you're.
Or that you don't have it, which I think is the swift boat, was the swift boat problem.
Right, right. And the thing was Kerry tough enough? I mean, voters are looking, and he said there's a great debate about our campaigns, a lens onto how you would be a president. And then there was a really great, I think it was Mark Halperin. He wrote a pretty interesting New York Times op-ed a few months ago where he said that he had made a mistake in his history by evaluating presidential candidates by saying that the kind of campaign they run and how good of a campaigner they are was a good index for the kind of president they would be. And we've made mistakes on that front. And sometimes politics isn't a great proxy for the kind of governor, you know, how you would be in government. But, you know, and his example was George Bush. George Bush was a tremendous campaigner. He's very good at politics, but it turns out that he's a crappy, you know, person in government. He doesn't govern very well. But this one question about toughness in political campaigns, I mean, how do you respond to somebody who's attacking you? How do you address inaccuracies or lies about your record? How do you, that actually is probably a valid element of politics to be looking at when you're evaluating somebody as a president. And that's where we are right in the thick of things as we speak. And that's what's going to happen next week. So we've just seen, you know, a kind of teaching moment of this week of how Democrats are actively fighting back against Republican attempts to make them look weak in the wake of Georgia, in the wake of with the ongoing Iraq, everything that's going on right now. I think they're acquitting themselves quite well. Now the question is, and with Biden as the nominee now, and with what he, the extraordinary speech, I think we are right on the brink now of how the Republicans are going to answer that.
And that to me is a fascinating question, because in a way, McCain has, I think, the harder challenge in terms of the pivot that he has to make. You know, he has his base comes in apparently more united, unless the vice presidential pick is something really surprising. There's not the disunity narrative going in, but there is the kind of lack of enthusiasm narrative, and that McCain has to do the pivot of both revving up the base and reaching out to the voter in the middle who, you know, is maybe seeing those ads with the Wisconsin Democratic woman who wants to vote for McCain now and is sort of saying, well, could I do that? And so McCain has to make the sale to those people at the same time as he has to rev up his own base. And that's a very hard set of stops to hit at the same time. And then, you know, which is where none of the vice presidential picks that are being talked about at the moment really, it seems to me, help you rev up the base very much.
Right.
So that to me is, and where something that I actually think this convention has done incredibly well is get the bass very revved up without doing a lot of things that allow the media commentator to go see those crazy, wacky, dangerous socialist Democrats. That everybody here is very revved up, very ready to go out and work, feels like their bases have been touched, but in a very non-divisive, non-scary to the independents way. And I think the Republicans are going to have an incredibly hard time matching that.
Right. I mean, that's what I was talking about last night when I saw that. I mean, in watching this, I almost got trampled with this Bill Clinton thing last night, literally. I mean, it was there was a level of intensity there. And I think we were just talking with just a few minutes ago, you and I, with somebody who was saying, you know, that she really feels that there is this unity now that is important. And I hadn't, to be honest, that had kind of eluded me before. I felt like I've worked in a lot of Virginia politics over the last, you know, over a decade. And the base there, the people that I spend time with, are extremely energized, and it feels that way. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I think there is this, not just a perception, but a reality that the party was a little bit, was divided with Hillary supporters, which I think have their own economic and their own demographic concerns, and that they were falling off, and that they were, and I do think that now, probably as a result of this week, you're going to see a spike in our base. I don't know what, that's a tremendous, I think that's a good insight about the McCain campaign, because I think that one of the reasons he's been so, there's been such a split personality of the campaign, is because he doesn't know, there are parallel tracks, just like he doesn't know whether to run as the maverick or as the neocon, which is, and he's been divided, he's been flip-flopping between those things. I think that the party doesn't know whether to run to the center or whether to run to the right. And I think that they're confused. That'll be fascinating next week. I mean, and they could end up stumbling, and I hope they do.
Well, when you think about it, I mean, Republicans do best when they have a candidate who's able to run as both of those things.
Right.
And George W. Bush, for all that people like to deride his abilities, was incredibly good at some sort of emotional level at checking both of those boxes at once and making people feel comfortable with him in both of those ways. I mean, in a Ronald Reagan-esque way.
Right.
George H.W. Bush was not that good at it, and that's part of the reason why he didn't get a second term. And I think John McCain, the fascinating thing about John McCain is that he's so very good at being who he is, that he's almost too good at being who he is, in a kind of non-substantive way. I'm groping a little bit for the words here. I guess I need yet another cup of coffee.
Yeah. Oh,
but
wait.
That McCain has a persona, that he's so good at being that persona, but when it comes to actually making hard, coherent choices about what fills that persona or what supports it, or how you manipulate it, maybe that's what I mean, is that he's not as good at manipulating. The persona is too rigid to be able to be manipulated as successfully as George W. Bush or Ronald Reagan, so that in fact, McCain's very good at running as the maverick war hero, but when he has to run as the maverick war hero who's also a strong supporter of everything that George W. Bush has tried to do for the last 8 years, when I say that, I realize it's a ridiculously tall order, but I think you have people who are politically talented enough to carry it off, and I actually think, in a crazy way, it's one of the things people like about McCain, that he can't do that, but he's now in an environment where he actually has to do it, and we'll see. And, you know, we'll also see how the choreography around him works.
Right.
Blogging Heads Nation, I want you to notice I'm being very careful about how I pronounce my words. After all that, let me ask you, is it, how do you pronounce, is it indefatigable or?
Indefatigable.
Indefatigable. Okay, well, there we have.
But I think.
There was
right?
an interesting.
I mean, it has to be.
There was a debate among the commentators about how it was pronounced.
What was the other?
I have a feeling that they thought I pronounced it wrong, and I'm now not remembering. I was so fatigued that I can't remember how I pronounced it.
I think you did just say choreograph. I think the choreography might have just come out, but I think that we're agreed on indefatigable, maybe.
Okay. Well, maybe this is as good a moment as any to pivot, as you see from our wonky ability to argue about word pronunciation. Michael, who sounds like a consummate operative, also has a secret wonk side to him, and that secret wonk side is that he has a PhD in political philosophy and is in the middle of working on a book about, I'll let you tell about the book.
It is a book that's titled Demagogue, The Fight to Save Democracy from Its Own Worst Enemy, and it is about the interrelationship between democracy, demagogues, constitutionalism, and foreign policy. And it aims to do three things. One is to explain how democracy, how we could have, the policymakers who are in charge of the democracy experiment in Iraq could have gotten it so wrong, could have thought that democracy could succeed just by installing these institutions and that it would somehow take off on its own. And there are really deep errors in thinking that led to that, and I think it's essential that we understand them, and the book provides a historical and way of understanding how democracy actually works. And the second thing is that provides a way forward of thinking about a foreign policy democracy that would be based on constitutionalism, which is a rich idea that's about citizens being committed to anti-authoritarian values in their lives and in their hearts and minds. And American history explains how constitutionalism actually works, something we don't think about as much as we should. And the third thing is it provides a very sort of what you might call left patriotism. It's an idea for progressives about how we should, how proud we should be of the way in which this nation has developed our own democracy and constitutionalism in the sort of hearts and minds of citizens. And we have, the book goes through, it has basically portraits of seven major political thinkers who have grappled with this problem of democracy, which is itself democracy will disintegrate in a tyranny left to its own devices through the demagogue, through a mass emotional manipulative leader, unless the people check it, unless people stop it. And there are a variety of great thinkers in history who have watched democracy start to collapse and who have either come out on the side of an authoritarian elite resolution of the problem, which is what Plato did, and it's what Leo Strauss did, who was the political thinker, who was the father of the neoconservatives, who ultimately generated the kind of democracy we first saw in Iraq in the beginning few years, which was such a disaster. And on the other side, you have the stories of the book are Aristotle, Thomas Jefferson, Alexis Tocqueville, and Hannah Arendt, which is really the heroine of the book, and they all came up with this rich citizen people-powered idea of democracy that actually is the one that works, but it takes a lot of time, and that's the one that America, for all of our foibles and missteps throughout our constitutional history, we do care very deeply about anti-authoritarian values. We have not seen a demagogue try to take over the country, which was the number one fear of the founding fathers. It's why we have the Electoral College, and we still haven't seen it, and it's amazing. You and I were just talking about, you're a Russia expert, we were talking about Russia. You see the danger now in a country where the people, the citizenry of a country, are not committed to anti-authoritarian values, and the citizens of Russia have a lot of love for Vladimir Putin, who is approaching now, as we're seeing. I mean, he could be a belligerent dictator on par with some of history's worst if this bad situation now doesn't get worse. And the citizens, I think, play a significant role in that.
Yeah, I think this is a fascinating thing to think about as we're sitting at a political convention and talking about what political leaders think they need to use rhetoric to do. And that, you know, what's been fascinating to me about this convention is that you're trying to, and it's resulted in, I think, some uneasiness about some of the speeches here, that you're very explicitly trying to use elite political rhetoric to reintroduce a feeling of popular ownership and popular control of the political process. So it's kind of trying to use demagogic means for anti-demagogic purposes. And so I think the fact that you had, you know, both the Warner speech and the Biden speech, which some people have been disappointed by and which maybe weren't the kind of high-flying oratory that I think people classically associate with political campaigns, yet I think both potentially very effective to particular audiences where we're exactly trying to send the message, hey, this isn't about people getting up and speaking in fancy sentences. So it's this kind of anti-rhetorical rhetoric.
Look, I think that's a fascinating point. I used to work for Mark Warner. I was his deputy counselor in Richmond. I've worked on both of his campaigns. I've known him for over a decade. And I learned actually from him that there is this totally different way for Democrats to go about winning. And what he, in his first, I mean, he ran for Senate in 1996, then he ran for governor in 2001, and one of the reasons he won in 2001 was because he went to, this was a guy who grew up in Connecticut, he was worth over $100 million as a venture capitalist in high tech. I mean, there was no reason to think that he would connect with ordinary working class people in Appalachian Virginia or in Southside or Southwest Virginia. And he went to them. He had nothing really in common with them. He didn't foster an accent, but he basically went and just tried to listen and understand their concerns. And in a very simple and direct way, he didn't condescend to them. He didn't try to use cultural symbols in a way that was insincere. He just went to people. We are all people. And one of the things, and it went and worked. He actually won a lot of the most rural and conservative counties where Democrats could win and where they had in the past by talking about economic needs and by talking about the loss of local jobs and by talking about cultural issues that actually were amenable to government solutions, like hunters and fishermen's issues and environmental issues and educational issues and healthcare. And he won. And one of the lessons, it's got a layer of political theory, it's got a layer of American history, and it's got a layer of foreign policy, but the concern throughout it that drops through all three of those layers is this thinking about the people. And the people are the alpha and omega of successful politics. And a lot of time liberals don't forget that. We think that ideas are. We think that historical narratives are. And Republicans have been very, very good at understanding that the people and however they live and think and talk and whatever they're looking for, you're ultimately always talking to people. And that, it's such a simple solution, but it is easy to forget because we can get absorbed into lots of other ways of trying to think and solve problems. But what you're talking about, Joe Biden is incredibly direct. He talks like people talk. I think that sophisticated...
He talks like some people talk.
He talks like more people talk than people like... A lot of the people, you and I are the people listening to this, with all due respect, talk. And that is something that we need to remember, which is that people want to hear people talk about, there are a lot of examples of this, but I think that, ordinary, direct, prosaic, we might think concerns and language and ideas are actually what politics should be about, because politics should be about ordinary people and their day-to-day lives and what they want and need. And that is going to be the sweet spot for Senator Obama as this moves forward, because he is very good. I mean, I know somebody who knew him at the University of Chicago for law school, and he went down and he saw him in Springfield one time, and he said the most amazing, he said he thought that he would be president at some point because he watched him in the course of one day. He tailed him. This was when he was a legislator. He met with a farmer. He met with somebody, from the legislature, met with all these people, and with all these different people, he talked to them as the same, and he connected with just ordinary people. And there was something that is that's an extraordinary talent, and that's what politics in America should be about.
Well, you're making me think of something really interesting about the Republican convention next week, which is it seems to me that for the last couple of election cycles, the Republicans have been able to do the reaching out to common folks largely through a fear-based narrative.
Right.
That sort of substituting for genuine connection of the kind that you're talking about has been this kind of genuine connection over fear.
Right.
Now, that didn't work so well in 2006. And I see McCain sometimes try to do something else and then fall back on it because, number one, it's what he knows. And number two, his whole life experience, I mean, I think it's genuine that his, and I've said this before, that the whole structure of his rhetoric is, we're under threat, and here's how I'm going to solve the threat. But that every speech, and especially the national security ones, begins with, I'm going to remind you of a time that our nation was in terrible peril. And now I'm going to tell you how our nation is in terrible peril.
Not to mention, every time he says anything, his major credo is his POW experience.
Oh, John McCain was a POW? I thought he didn't talk about that.
Right, which immediately invokes this, terror-struck, tragic past.
Right. So that, to me, is one of the big interesting rhetorical questions for the Republican convention, is as it becomes more and more clear that the American public is focused, number one, two, and three on economic issues, and then number four on national security, how much do you go back to the national security fear-based narrative, and how much do you try to pivot off it?
Right. Right. I mean, I think that's the essential question. I mean, how much... Look, this is a big... Usually the way that you win these elections is you frame that it is a massively important interview for a massively important job, and the people who are considering the candidate want to know, what are you going to do for me? I mean, that is at a very simple, elemental level. That's what people want. They're hiring somebody running for president. They want to know, what are you going to do for me? And that is a future-oriented request. And so these elections usually are about the future. And when Republicans, in their divisive, negative way, end up trumping that essential dynamic for their fear-based narrative and making it about fear, it's true. Now, it does go deep. I mean, this research and work I've been doing for a decade on demagogues, I mean, it is true that one of the best ways to be a demagogue is to use fear, because it is a simple, unifying, lowest common denominator, highly emotionalized way of being involved in politics. And Republicans have recognized that. But it is not actually the best way to win, or to be most successful. And we saw this with Bill Clinton. We saw this with John F. Kennedy, with the new generation of leadership. We've seen it.
We saw it in 2006 in the congressional elections, where tons of Republican candidates tried to use it and found it didn't work for them anymore.
Absolutely. And so I think that we should recognize we do have a sweet spot. Democrats are good at this because, I mean, the whole, you know, we call ourselves progressives nowadays, and there is something in that, which is progress. It is an idea that means that you are moving from here to there, and you're moving from here up. And we have ownership, rightfully, over the idea of progress in American politics. And I thought that Bill Clinton actually did this very, very well last night. He talked about progress in the future. And, I mean, my goodness, this is Obama's entire personal narrative. It's his entire ideas. It's the themes of his campaign. And so we're good on this. I think that we should be very confident. And this is, if it comes down to their politics of fear versus our politics of progress and moving up, we will win that. We will win that. We just have to not lose it on the other issues.
Yeah. No, and it's, I think it's fascinating because you have such a clean contrast. But the two candidates, one of whom is saying, you know, our best days are behind us and I'm going to take you back to that,
right,
versus the other one who's saying, I incarnated my own story, the best future that we haven't had yet, and which is just a fascinating, you couldn't ask for a clearer contrast. Our alert viewers will have noticed that there were some ghost figures scrolling through here a minute ago, which is a signal that we probably need to get ready to move out and go prepare for our six-hour siege at the Rock Concert / Obama speech tonight. By the time you see this, it'll all be history. So thanks for sharing the time in Denver with us, and see you all on the screen another time. And Mike, have a great day.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to meet everybody.